ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
People living right on the beach on the central coast of New South Wales say they are sitting ducks as coastal erosion shrinks the beach frontage protecting their homes. And the problem of what to do about it is dividing families and neighbours alike.
On families, you know, husbands and wives that are fighting, you know, people that now want to leave the community.
And traditional owners return back to country more than 2 years since the once-in-a-century floods devastated the Mornington Wildlife Sanctuary in the Kimberley region of Western Australia.
That would be great.
I'm Sinead Mangan and this is Australia Wide, coming to you from Whadjuk Country, Perth. But first to New South Wales, to the Central Coast, a beautiful part of the country where people choose to live there because you can live metres from the ocean. However, coastal erosion is whipping away large chunks of the shoreline, putting that lifestyle at risk. And as our reporter in Gosford, Sarah Foster, found out, while one community on the Central Coast is pushing ahead with the solution, the other remains at loggerheads over the best way forward.
A decades-long problem spanning the length of the coast is making waves once again.
It's been kicked down the road by government after government not addressing it.
Two Central Coast beaches grappling with coastal erosion are addressing it in two very different ways. At the entrance north, residents have been given permission to conduct interim works to protect their properties from the sea. It will set homeowners like Paul Green back more than $100,000 each.
Roughly around 5 metre wall, rock revetment wall, and then it will have sand nourishment behind and on top of it. And hopefully that will keep collecting sand and bring back the beach. And then straight after that, we will be applying for a DA to make a permanent revetment wall there, which will be good for the future.
Severe weather events earlier this year saw the state government declare this beach a reconstruction zone. That allowed owners to fast-track the process without submitting a development application. It's the first time Recovery Minister Janelle Saffin has used new powers to address an erosion risk. She believes the interim works could provide a longer-lasting fix.
The revetment and the sand nourishment works that I understand they'll be doing, they have the potential to last quite some time.
Just a few beaches south, Wombril has also been declared a reconstruction zone, but it's made little difference. Central Coast Council says there is no immediate significant risk of structural collapse, so it won't apply for state-sanctioned protection works. The issue has proved so divisive that last month two anti-seawall campaigners were charged with assaulting a homeowner at Wombril, and the council has taken that same homeowner to court over the unauthorised placement of rock bags to reinforce his property. A DA for a vertical seawall has been pending for more than 2 years. Sam Borton almost won the safe Liberal seat of Terrigal for Labor on an anti-seawall platform.
If you put a wall there, then what you get is these big waves crashing against the wall and dragging all that sand offshore. That sand then doesn't replenish as well as it would have in a natural dune ecosystem.
But he agrees a solution is needed and believes it could come in the form of a buried revetment wall.
That is an option that most people are pretty comfortable with. That's a wall that sits underneath the sand level, and then you pump sand on top of that to create more stability, and obviously you don't lose beach amenity with that, and that's an acceptable solution that I think most people in the community would be for. The thing that community is really against is a hard vertical seawall which will destroy the beach.
Chris Rogers owns a beachfront home in Wombril and says the issue is taking a toll.
On families, you know, husbands and wives that are fighting, you know, people that now want to leave the community.
He says homeowners would be happy with a revetment to stabilise their homes and protect the beach.
We're more than happy to look at an alternative solution. And if that can be done quicker and we can implement it and please everyone, bring it on.
Sarah Forster reporting from Gosford on the central coast of New South Wales.
ABC Australia Wide.
A not-for-profit retailer that runs supermarkets in remote communities across North Queensland has successfully applied for an exemption to anti-discrimination laws that will allow it to refuse the sale of drinks like non-alcoholic wine and beer to customers under the age of 18. It's a move that's been backed by research, as Christopher Testa explains.
Zero alcohol or low alcohol alternatives to popular alcoholic drinks such as wine and beer aren't completely new to Australian supermarket shelves, but their popularity is increasing. It's leading to debate about how and where these products should be marketed and sold. Community Enterprise Queensland runs about 30 retail outlets in remote, mostly Indigenous communities. Its health and nutrition manager, Melinda Hammond, says the feedback from those communities has been clear.
There's actually a lack of evidence that the products are safe for children. And we were aware of that. And we talked to our communities about their health aspirations. And community gave a resounding majority view that they did not want these products sold to children.
CEQ wanted the right to refuse to sell zero alcohol drinks to children. And so it went to the Queensland Civil and Administrative Tribunal seeking an exemption from sections of the state's Anti-Discrimination Act. The company was able to get a 5-year exemption that allows it to refuse the sale of those drinks to minors, to ask customers for proof of age, and put up signs advising them of the new age restriction. Melinda Hammond says that application was bolstered with evidence from the Menzies School of Health Research and the University of Melbourne Law School.
They highlighted that there's concerns that there could be problem with the as a gateway. So the drinks, because they mimic alcohol products in taste, branding, packaging and marketing, it could normalise alcohol consumption among young people and behave as sort of that gateway to drinking. And those researchers, they've surveyed young people, and of the people that they surveyed, one third had already consumed these products, with many buying them in supermarkets and local stores.
Research into the relationships young people have with zero alcohol drinks is still developing, but the early findings have shown the alcohol-like branding does resonate with teenagers. A survey of Australian 15 to 17-year-olds last year found more than half believed zero alcohol products looked appealing. Professor Jacqueline Bowden is director of the National Centre for Education and Training on Addiction at Flinders University.
I think that is absolutely outstanding leadership, and they've obviously listened to the community as well. They are worried. You know, it sounds like they've seen and heard the evidence that is coming out showing that these could be and are very likely to be gateway drinks. There's lots of reasons to be concerned about them. On balance, from a public health perspective, you know, if they're available to adults, they can be a good alternative to drinking alcohol, which is what we want to see. But for young people, certainly, I think they've taken an excellent step in the right direction.
Professor Bowden says there is a case for further nationwide regulation about how these products can be sold.
Because we are seeing these big displays of these products, and it is really hard. You know, you just have to stand in a supermarket in the soft drink aisle now, and it's really hard to work out what soft drink and what's the zero alcohol drinks. Before you know it, you know, people are accidentally buying zero alcohol drinks for kids' parties and things like that unintentionally. You know, anything we can do to kind of reduce kids getting exposure to these alcohol brands at an early age is really important.
Michael Waters is the CEO of the Peak Body for Bottle Shops, Retail Drinks Australia. He says there's been steady growth in demand for zero alcohol alternatives.
It's not a huge sector of the market. It's growing organically, but it's not huge. It is predicted to continue to grow, but we see that this is a good thing where it's designed to be marketed and sold to adults because it helps support and underpin a more responsible drinking culture in Australia.
Retail Drinks says it doesn't condone the sale or marketing of drinks held out to be alcohol to children. But Michael Waters isn't convinced there's a need to legislate any further.
I don't believe there's sufficient evidence to say that there's a big problem out there that needs fixing or addressing. Our industry, which is the licensed retail liquor sector, we take our responsibility very seriously. And for our sector across Australia, these types of products are only ever to be marketed and sold to adults, not to minors. So if other non-licensed sectors want to choose decisions to suit their own requirements, then we certainly wouldn't stand in their way. You know, we're supportive of specialised solutions for specialised issues.
Melinda Hammond says CEQ will start checking its customers for ID once it's trained staff and informed customers about the new rules.
Not all of our stores choose to stock the products, but where we did talk to people, there is some view that they're a harm minimisation opportunity for adults, and so they may have a place in community, but there was an overwhelming view that they should not be available to children.
Melinda Hammond from Community Enterprise Queensland, ending that story from Christopher Tester.
This is ABC Australia Wide.
She may look ordinary, but she's the stuff of science fiction. The world's first sheep cloned from another adult. The experiment in which she was created was carried out at the Rosslyn Institute near Edinburgh. Scientists here have already produced genetically identical sheep from the same embryo. But never before has one sheep...
That was back in 1996. Dolly the sheep was a scientific marvel, promising a new world in genetic technology that could reshape the world that we live in. But 30 years later, did Dolly and the science that stemmed from her short six-year life deliver? In a new podcast series, Artificial Evolution, my guest, ABC Environment reporter Peter DeCruff, has followed the story of gene technologies all the way from Dolly right through to the present day. The story does take some peculiar twists and turns, with bizarre criminal conspiracy to clone the world's largest sheep, to the lab trying to bring back long extinct species, and new trials transplanting animal organs into humans. And remarkably, some of these Frankenstein-like science involves a property in the Hawkesbury region of New South Wales, where 80 horses have been cloned, many for the sport of polo. Peter, let's start at the beginning with Dolly the sheep, as we just heard, because I think most of our listeners would be familiar with her. Whatever happened to poor Dolly?
Dolly was created using this cloning technique, somatic nuclear cell transfer, a whole garble of words in your mouth there. But basically, and what you kind of heard in that clip is they took an adult cell, so just a cell from a sample from Dolly, and they put that into like an egg cell that had its own little kind of genetic identity removed. And so by putting the cell from Dolly into that and then putting that into another sheep, like a surrogate mum, you created an animal that had the same genetic profile as where you took the sample from. So that was Dolly.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a big deal. That was the first time we'd done that with a mammal. And that's where we started going, oh, my God, can we do this with humans? Mm-hmm. And all these laws and legislation
started coming through. It was huge at the time.
It was massive.
Yeah.
And so Dolly herself, yep, only lasted for 6 years, but she did manage to have a few kids, so she, you know, successfully had her own children. And if you want to see Dolly, her body's actually taxidermied in the National Museum in Scotland.
Wow. As you said, it all got a bit mad there for a while, and it wasn't just enough to clone one sheep and for that sheep to have babies. The science world kind of got fixated on, right, we've produced a sheep, now let's produce a big sheep. What was that all about?
Yeah, so all these other kind of species started popping up. But particularly looking at sheep and what kind of drew me into this whole world and kind of looking at where we're at now was a bit of a news headline from last year, which was a Montana, farmer, sheep breeder who had been arrested for like a 10-year kind of cloning conspiracy.
Right.
Where they'd illegally brought in some samples of what's called as a Marco Polo sheep. So it's this rarish, this near threatened species in the mountains around Kyrgyzstan, that kind of area. Really massive horns. It's something that people actually pay to go hunt over there. And there are treaties against, you know, trafficking them to other countries or even samples or materials of them, like how you can't take elephant tusks around the place.
Mm.
So they managed to get a sample, bring it in the States, send it off to a lab who cloned them, who sent them back an embryo, which then they sort of created their own clone on farm and then started breeding that with other big sheep, all to create the ultimate hunting sheep. And when we spoke to Matt Brown, who's an AP reporter in Montana, who followed this story.
This was unique to me. This was a new one. We've done plenty of stories on illegal hunting and the lengths that people go to get animals, but this was the first time when it had taken a detour through a laboratory to create clones. And this was a whole new level of enthusiasm, I'll say, for big sheep. It definitely is science fiction come to life.
AP reporter Matt Brown there. Now let's move away from the sheep shenanigans. So we've got a big sheep, we've got Dolly the sheep. But tell me about the cloning that's happening here in Australia, Peter.
There's a guy who lives just outside of Sydney, North Richmond, in the Hawkesbury region, involved in the polo scene. And polo, internationally, once people were able to clone a horse in 2003, the first one was in Italy, it became actually quite prominent in polo, particularly in Argentina and the US, this cloning of polo horses. And so seeing a niche kind of in Australia, this fella, John Farron Price, decided to actually start his own horse cloning operation from the ground up, basically, to be able to clone horses, you know, mostly for polo.
So one of the cloned horses that John Farron Price was involved was called Rex. And there's been numbers of iterations. I don't know what you say. Rex 1, Rex 2, Rex 3. But how have the different Rexes differed from each other?
Yeah, so Rex is a polo horse owned by a guy called Ben Kay, who lives in Victoria, who's a polo player. And it's just the best horse he's ever ridden, basically. Real fun guy. He loves his horse. And he's actually getting 9 clones of Rex.
Over what period of time?
Well, so actually, so 6 of the clones are alive and breathing and well. They were born this year between May and July. So they're over at Catalina, the property, the business that does the cloning. They're over there now. They're all a little different. And you'll hear from Carlene Hennig and John Farron Price here about some of those horses.
It's really exciting. I love watching them learn and grow and like the similarities and the differences between all of them. For example, we've got the first Rex. He was born when we didn't have too many foals on farms, so he was very spoiled. So he's extremely friendly and will come up to you in the paddock for a pet. Whereas, say, Rex 3, for example, we had about 12 clones on property at that time. So he didn't get as much attention. So he's a little bit more standoffish. He's still very curious and wants to get to interact with people, but he's a bit more cautious, but he'll come around.
And then you'll start to see differences, subtle differences with these guys. So it's the same with the Tweed and Twill. You'll notice that their base color is the same. They broadly share the same level of muscle mass. To the untrained eye, they're identical, but then if you start to drill down on things like the blaze, so the coloring of their face, they're all unique. Which again is really cool because I think it kind of speaks to the fact that they're not, I think one of the public's great misconceptions is that they are just a photocopy of the original, and they're absolutely not. They all have subtle differences that make them unique, and that really shows through with these 6 Rex clones. They obviously kind of anchor back to the same DNA, but for a whole host of reasons, they're quite different even at this young age.
That's John Farron Price, who's cloning horses in the Hawkesbury region of New South Wales. Now, I think I thought up until now that these clones would be photocopies of each other. So does this, aside from the physicality of it, the blaze, as you said, is this the differences between Rex 1 and Rex 6, for example? Is this a nature or nurture thing?
Yeah, there's elements of it for sure. I think from what we sort of heard researching the series, because what you're hoping for, particularly with something like a polo horse, is kind of get the same kind of calm temperament as the original horse. But I guess for people who get it, they just kind of feel as though rather than getting like, you know, a pony from that particular animal, you're not really quite sure how that's going to turn out personally wise or anything like that. I think they just kind of feel like they're going to get closer to the mark, particularly if it's a higher performance horse. But there will be differences because so their mums from whom they are born, you know, they're learning from them. So there's a bit more here from Carlene and our producer James Bullen picked up at the property.
So this is Rex 5.
Sure.
He was born July 3rd out of a non-maiden mare, so she's had a foal before. This one's quite friendly. He was in a box for 2 weeks, so that's one of those, like, nurture aspects of them.
I've never really been around horses that much, to be honest. Yeah.
You just keep your hand flat.
Flat.
So they don't,
right.
Any kind of
he is cheeky
bit, they'll just, if you put your hand out like that, they'll just take your fingers. So.
Yeah, right.
Well, not take them, but
give them a little nibble. Yeah. Yeah.
Ooh. Hey, stop it.
That's Carlene Henning there. Now, the mind boggles in terms of this cloning, you know, the idea of Rex 1 and Rex 2 and Rex 3. I mean, to me, it is astounding. But it is a commercial endeavour. Who is buying these clones?
Yeah, I mean, Polo, I mean, first of all, it costs you about 50 grand Australian to get a horse, which doesn't sound too bad in the scheme of things, how expensive some horses, you know, get. There was a clone, Argentina, where it's very big, there was a clone of a very good polo horse that sold for well over 800,000 US at auction, and that was right in the early days of cloning. So it goes right from, like, really, you know, high-performing athletes who really rely on having a good horse, and then kind of similar to the pet cloning that happens in other countries like the US and China, people just get a certain affinity for an animal, and, you know, they kind of want to have the same-ish animal. So, you know, you might get the same thing there too, where people just have a really close tie to a particular horse, and that's what they want.
It's interesting, though, because when Dolly came out 30 years ago, you know, it was huge news, but it did kind of fall away. And you're talking about niche areas here, you know, polo, pets. Why hasn't cloning completely taken off?
It's quite inefficient. I mean, Dolly came from, there was nearly 300 embryos that they created, you know, from that process of taking a cell and putting it into an empty egg. Each of those turns into an embryo. So, yeah, they had, you know, 270-odd embryos, about 30-something of those actually went into potential surrogate mums, and from that, only one was successful and was Dolly.
Mm.
They were successful after that with a few more exactly genetically the same as Dolly, who actually lived a lot longer than Dolly. But those kind of inefficiencies haven't they've improved a bit, but it's still a developing technology in a way. And you know, the folks doing this horse cloning, they've had in Australia, there's no sort of patent you get from someone else. They're figuring it all out, right, in the last kind of 5 years of them creating, you know, 80-odd horses. I think some people say the real legacy of Dolly has been more that what we've learnt about what we can do around stem cell, you know, research, and it's quite interesting, you know, stem cell that sort of therapy involving, you know, creating stem cells from, you know, your own genetics in a way, so before it turns into a full cloned human or something, which is highly regulated. But actually at this horse farm in Sydney, they're doing this kind of therapy with horses where they've got sore tendons or things, so they're taking their genetics and then they're creating stem cells to then put back into the horse to kind of heal them. And that's not really regulated for the animals, but highly regulated for the people. You know, and there's all that sort of kind of research going on. So it's, yeah, it's like a lot's happened and a lot hasn't happened.
Well, if you want to hear more about what has and hasn't happened, Peter de Cruyff is across it and he's put a podcast together. It's called Science Friction. It was launched today and you can find it on the ABC Listen app. Thanks very much, Peter, for talking to Australia Wide.
Thanks.
You're listening to Australia Wide.
They've terrorised our poor sheep. They've terrorised our peacocks, chased away all our chickens.
Yeah, it's been a bit hectic. yeah, they're reasonably commonish as far as snakes go here around the reserve.
On ABC Radio.
More than 2 years since once-in-a-century floods devastated the Mornington Wildlife Sanctuary in the Kimberley region of Western Australia, Boonabit traditional owners have returned back to country. As part of a flood recovery grant funded by the federal government, the Australian Wildlife Conservancy and Boonabit traditional owners organised an on-country camp focused on reconnecting families back to their country and visiting cultural sites to assess any flood damage. Dunya Karajic has this report.
Far along a bumpy dirt track off the Gibb River Road, Boonabba woman Monique Middleton sits on a riverbank surrounded by her family.
Well, our heart is here, to tell you the truth.
This is where our great-grandmother was born. This is their country. The family's here now, are reconnecting back to country. Some of them are first time connecting back here. So we're passing our history that we know and knowledge onto the other family members that are connected in this area.
This is the first time many of them have been back to their country since catastrophic floods devastated the region more than 2 years ago.
The Fitzroy Valley turned to an inland sea.
Cut off by an ocean of water in the vast floodplains of the Fitzroy River.
The devastating cost of a once-in-a-century flood.
This country, Mulungu, is part of more than 400,000 hectares of land called Mornington, an animal sanctuary run by the Australian Wildlife Conservancy, or AWC for short. Together with AWC, Miss Middleton has worked on developing this post-flood recovery project, made possible by federal government funding.
The focus since the flood is coming back to Mulungu Moi, looking at how the flood got affected since the last time we're here, but also reconnecting back through our cultural obligations that we have to follow, that where we were taught.
AWC Regional Operations Manager and Conservation Ecologist Dr. Sky Cameron says as part of the grant, they're visiting sacred sites by car and helicopter to assess any damage post-flooding.
It's hard to get to a lot of these sites, so we haven't visited all of them, but the aim of this camp is to get out and actually look how badly they were impacted by the flood and what we can do in the future to build some resilience into those sites.
Driving along a dirt track away from the riverbank, Elder Selena Middleton directs Dr. Cameron through thick scrub towards a cultural site. It's called Anar Malay, which translates to Honey Increase Site, and it's one she hasn't visited for years.
We go to that area if we need more honey or animal life, our cultural stuff around here, you know, all our things that live on honey. We go and talk to the site and it gives us honey.
Stepping outside of their vehicle and walking towards the rock face, Miss Middleton begins calling out to the site in language.
I just asked if they could put some more honey for us.
Nice. That would be good.
Together on an app, they begin documenting any damage and weeds that have emerged in the region.
Nah, it looked right.
Do we want to fill this in?
Dr. Cameron says it's important record keeping for traditional owners.
So what we've done for this On Country camp is created an app, and we're going out, and every time we go to a site that's important to people, we can record and take photos, store that data, and then they can use that information into the future. So if they come back to a site in a year or two or 10 or 20 years, that they're going to go, oh, that's what it used to look like. This is how it's changed. And it puts it all in one place.
For Bunuba man Barry Middleton, it's been 2 decades since he's returned here to where his grandmother was born. With most of the family based in Fitzroy Crossing, more than 6 hours away via corrugated roads, coordinating visits is difficult.
Well, it's good to be back home to see the old things again. My grandmother used to survive and live over this land, on top of the hills, near the rivers. Very hard to understand. That's how their life was, living along these hills and the rivers and the springs. It was a difficult life. When I first saw a white man, that the thing came for difficult.
Around Mr. Middleton, young kids spend the day kayaking down the river, fishing, or competing on who can throw rocks into the water the furthest. He says it's special seeing many of them connect to their country for the first time.
They're doing things like they don't really do it at town. You got kids walking around in circles in town, but here you've got everything to see. You can climb hills, swim the river, walk in the scrub. You can play with anything along here. That's how we grew up as kids.
This camp is just one part of an ongoing partnership between AWC and traditional owners, working to protect country into the future.
That was reporter Dunya Karadzic ending that report on Malungu country. And that is Australia Wide for this Wednesday. I'm Sinead Mangan. Cheerio.
ABC Listen.